This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. On January 10th, 1982, one of the most remarkable and memorable plays in NFL history occurred. Then later that year, the 1982 strike happened. This was an important year for this week's guest, as it was the first time he started covering an NFL team. Later in his career, he would meet up and cover the player in this famous play. The play, you ask? Well, it is simply referred to as the catch.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great
Scott. This time as we step off the DeLorean, the date is January 10th, 1982 in San Francisco at Candlestick Park. We're here to witness the 1981 NFC Championship game, or simply referred to as the game with the catch. This would be a game that would ultimately end up, let's say, essentially passing the torch from the Cowboys to the 49ers as the dominant NFC team. And then they would be on this journey towards a dynasty. We're really kind of like multiple dynasties, you know, 80s, 90s, and all that kind of thing. But the thing is, this week's guest, a little bit later after this game, not too many years after, he would cover the 49ers basically as a beat reporter. So he would get to talk to many of these players that were in this game and beyond. It was just a coincidence that he happened to start covering the league the same year that this game happened. Well, I mean, maybe not the same season, but the year thereafter. This week's guest, well, his name is Clark Judge. Now, I don't mean Judge Clark Judge because he's the one that's bringing down the gavel. What I'm talking about is, well, in a way, he kind of is a judge because he's a Hall of Fame voter, and he's been so for quite a while now. He's also the co-host of something called the Talk of Fame Network. Basically, think about a podcast, radio show, but they talk about old football players, and a lot of it has to do with, well, should this guy be in the hall or should he not be in the hall and that kind of thing. He's also somebody who's been in the league for almost 40 years. Basically, overall, just a very knowledgeable person on the history of the game. And that's kind of the reason why I reached out to Clark in the first place. Really, it all revolved around because he's a Hall of Fame voter. And we're going to learn about that process, at least a good portion of the process and how that all goes down. That's why I wanted to bring him on. But by then, you know, it's like we start talking about that, we have all these other things. You're going to find out that the story goes in many more interesting ways than I couldn't even think of and couldn't even keep up track of. So not going to have to tell you on this intro. What I'm going to do is I'm going to leave links to Clark's site and other information in the show notes for you over at the website, which you can get to through your show notes, through your podcast player, or by heading to thefootballhistorydude.com, which now takes you over to my page on the Sports History Network, the headquarters for your favorite sports yesteryear. This is a network at the very early stages, so if you know of a podcast or another show that you think should be on the network, or maybe you're looking to start your own history podcast about your favorite sport, team, or league, well, go ahead and hit us up over on the site. But I must warn you, this is the first part of a two-part interview, and the second will be released next week, which means you should definitely go ahead and mash that subscribe button on your podcast player of choice. That way you get the hottest, freshest out of the press episodes each and every week. But for now, let's dive into the interview with Clark Judge.
It's kind of both and everything, that is. And that kind of leads me, you said that your wife actually worked at the NFL office for you guys?
Yeah, she was the at the time, she was the highest ranking female executive in the NFL office.
Is that how you got into football, or was this like way like after the fact?
It was after the fact. That's how I got to know her. I was covering high schools in Baltimore as a young reporter, and then got promoted by a freakish thing to covering the University of Maryland basketball. And then the next year they said, we want you to cover the Colts, and I went, geez, oh my God. And I had grown up a Baltimore Colts fan, so I was a little bit in awe of, I'm going to be covering the Colts. Are you kidding me? And so I did. It was the strike season 1982. And that was a very difficult way to break in because there was a 57-day strike. I didn't know what I was doing, but I had a lot of people take care of me. And I'm talking about other reporters, veteran reporters that I got a lot of respect for. Vito Stellino was one. Don Pearson from the Chicago Tribune was another. Guys who really knew their way around Gordon Forbes, and got to know them well, and it was a great experience. And then from there, I covered the NFL the next year for the Baltimore Sun, and there was an opening in San Diego. And to be honest with you, I really didn't want to go. I wanted to stay in Baltimore, loved it, but I couldn't get the job that they were trying to get me, and they were going to make me the assistant sports editor, and the assistant sports editor wasn't going to move. So I moved to San Diego, and I loved it out there. I loved it, and then moved up to San Francisco to cover the 49ers. That was the greatest job I ever had. It was a great team to cover. I love the Bay Area. It was a great team to cover, and I got to know those guys really well. I was single. I spent all my time out there. I didn't have anything else to do, and I'd be out there on their days off, and I remember, like, on Tuesdays, and it'd be like 9 o'clock at night, Mike Shanahan would come down. He goes, God almighty, you still here? What are you doing here? I said, I got nowhere else to go. I like this place. I like it. And it really helped, because they realized you weren't going away. So I basically sort of lived with the team while I was there, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I really miss seeing those guys. And Dwight Clark was my closest ally, and I do consider him a friend. And so when he passed away, it was a real blow to me. And I was privileged enough to be invited to his funeral, and I went out there, and it was tough. I mean, I saw all those guys that I knew in the locker room. They'd age, so did I. But it's tough to say goodbye to him. He was great.
Yeah, so it was a... I guess, I don't know, there's these air quotes. I don't know if you could see my screen, beat reporter, whatever you want to call it, for a team. So I'm an outsider. I wouldn't know how that game works. So it's really like that, where you're kind of mingling with the team and you feel almost like part of the team, or is that not always the case?
No, I mean, it depends on how hard you work. And I've always had a strong work ethic. I like working hard. And with the 49ers, it was fun. I mean, I didn't have any family there. My friends were few because I just moved there from San Diego. So I devoted my whole first year to covering that team because I knew I had to make an impact. I was going against some entrenched reporters, and they wanted me to make some inroads for the Mercury News, who I was working for. And quite honestly, I mean, I made an immediate impact, and I was very, very proud of what I did in that first year. And at the end of the first year, a couple guys from the PR staff came to me and they said, you've completely changed the way this beat's covered. But I did it the way I knew how from San Diego and from Baltimore. And it was just doing it is not going to bed until you're completely satisfied. You cover every angle of that story and got to know the people well there. And leaving there was tough. I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life in Bay Area. And sometimes I wish I had with my wife. I mean, I really would like my wife to have moved out there, but it wasn't going to happen. So, I look back on that. That was just great time. Great time.
Is that what you went into, I guess, your career? What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Wasn't sure. When I went into newspapers, it was after I'd come out of graduate school. Immediately, I was at the University of Missouri Graduate School of Journalism and came out of there immediately and started doing courtrooms, Board of Education for a paper here in Connecticut, Middletown Press. Middletown's like 35 to 40,000 people. The press ending circulation is something like 30,000, whatever. Afternoon paper, but it's a good way to start out. And the staff that we had was remarkable because you always, when you got out of graduate school, you didn't know where you could get a job. You didn't, because somebody had to give you an opportunity to get something on record. But every time you would apply someplace, they go, well, do you have like 2 years worth of copy that you've done? Well, no. Show us some of your clippings. I don't have any because I'm just coming out of school. Will somebody give you a chance? Who's going to give you that chance? And that paper actually served that purpose. They gave you that chance. And so on the staff, we had a guy from Harvard. There was a guy from Yale. There was a girl from Bryn Mawr, a guy from Haverford, and they were all young. And it was a great group. And the guy from Haverford went on to win a Pulitzer Prize later. The woman from Bryn Mawr went on to cover the White House. The guy from Harvard was the head of a huge PR firm in Chicago that you would know if I mentioned the name. And so we had a lot of success in that group. But within that group, I was doing the city side for a year. Within that group, there was a sports department, and the sports department wasn't what I consider very strong. In fact, it was pretty weak. But the sports editor was a great guy, and he was an older guy. But his assistant sports editor left, and he came to me and said, I'd like you to be my assistant sports editor. And I said, I'd love to do that. And I realized if by doing that, you could get a freedom to cover whatever you wanted, high school, it was mostly high schools, however you wanted, how often you wanted. And you could lay out the pages. I had done that at the University of Missouri. I love doing page layouts. I had a minor in art. So I love doing that. And I thought there was a freedom here that I couldn't get elsewhere. So I jumped at it. And the managing editor took me aside and he said, I understand you're thinking about moving to sports. And I said, I am. He goes, you're making a big mistake. And I said, why? He goes, because you've really pigeonholed yourself. You can't really go very far there. You can on city side, you can go off in a number of different directions, cover whatever you want. Here you can be limited. And I said, but it's what I want to do. It's what I want to do. And he goes, okay, then do it. And that's, and I did that ever since. I covered high school sports there, had a blast. I mean, had, and we completely transformed the section and made it something that was in this county where I live. Now I come back 40 years later. It's hard to believe, but we made it a go-to space and it was fun. But after a while, I needed more. I needed more of a challenge. And then that's when I went to Baltimore.
That was almost like a blessing, though. Like you started with this small firm that gave you your shot, and then you got to get into the sports and just totally transform it. And then,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
When you went to Baltimore, what was that like going from, like you said, the smaller town to the big city, I guess you could say?
It was the big city. And I'd grown up a Colts fan, so I sort of loved the idea of going there, seeing the football team that I grew up in. Admiring and loving, and I had a very good friend from college who lived there, and so I knew I had friends there, and I lived with him for the first month until I found a place of my own. And it was overwhelming initially, but then I realized everything I'd learned in journalism school was there, and everything I've been doing was there. It's just on a bigger scale. But they said, is there any chance, like, for the, this was another afternoon paper, the Evening Sun, that you could go down and cover some of the stuff in the composing room? And went, yeah, I've done that before. And I was my, you know, mid-20s, or, you know, 27, or 27, something like that. And yeah, I've done that. I mean, it's easy. And so they had me doing Agate, then they had me doing high schools, and then maybe the high school sports editor. And I loved that. And then they said, as I mentioned, there was just a quirky thing. The ACC basketball tournament was a big deal. It was a big deal then, and still is, but it was completely different then. And the night before it was to start, they called me at home. They said, what are you doing? And I said, watching TV. And they said, can you get a plane tomorrow for Greensboro? I said, why? Our Maryland basketball writer has gotten sick. We need you to go down there. I went, you got to be kidding me. I mean, I know nothing about Maryland basketball. That's okay. Just do whatever you can and go down there and give us stories. Okay, I did. And I covered the tournament for whatever it was, 4 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And when I got back, they said, you knocked it out of the park. We want you to be the Maryland beat writer next year. I went, what? They said, yeah. So I became the Maryland beat writer the next year. And that was 1 year of covering Lefty Driesell. And I've got to tell you, it was one of the most intriguing, interesting, and fun times I've ever had, because he was a character. And I learned a lot on there. And that was sort of intimidating to me, because then you're going up against the Washington Post and the Baltimore News American, then the Washington Times, that you're going up against some heavy hitters, because Maryland was a big program and still is, but it was different than with Lefty. And we go across the country, and then I realized, you know, this is a little bit different. I mean, now you really got to be on your toes, because in high school, you're covering, you know, some teams that maybe, you know, not many people are, but you've got all your own stats. And you're taking care of them yourself. And it may be different than that guy's, but you know that yours are right, whether they are not, or they are or not. But you know, you feel like they're right. So I love doing that. But Maryland was different. And then I realized, I'll never forget the first time they were giving me play-by-play. And I went, wait a minute, I don't have to do play-by-play myself? You give me these pretty cheap. What? And then, you know, and there's food here. You give out food? I mean, I was just like, what? And so that was a prelude then to a year later, the Baltimore Colts. The Colts writer left and they said, we'd like you to cover the Colts. And I'm like, this is crazy. I mean, what? You know, I'm my late 20s and this has happened all so fast. I was covering high schools a couple of years ago, but I kept learning on the way up. And then that the Colts experience was tough because I'm going into uncharted territory against veteran football writers, and they know the players and they know the shortcuts and they know everything else. I didn't. And so I just realized I'm going to get my brains beaten in for a few days, weeks, whatever. Just got to take it all in stride. And honestly, lucky for me, the strike happened because that changed everything. And then you're covering something that no one really has a playbook for. And I went up to New York. Some of the meetings were down in Baltimore, and that was great because I got to know people. And actually, I got to know enough people at the NFL that they offered me a job several times. And I turned it down because I liked the freedom of writing and writing what I wanted to write. And so I covered the Colts that year. The next year, the guy who left, you know, who made the job vacant, he came back. And they said, well, he's coming back, so we're putting him on the Colts and we're putting you on the NFL. And I didn't get that. And I was actually dismayed by it. But again, a very helpful step because I started covering the league. And I'll never forget going up to Pittsburgh when Terry Bradshaw was coming back from his injury. And it was in 1983. And he's going to play for the first time since he's been out. And it's against the Jets. And today, if he it was a Wednesday or Tuesday, whenever it was, I flew up there. There would be probably 200 people there because Terry Bradshaw, he's going to play. And, you know, he's coming back, the Hall of Fame to be quarterback and Super Bowl champion. And he's going to play again. And the Steelers now, they've got Terry Bradshaw back. He's going to play for the first time. And it was me and Fred Mitchell from the Chicago Tribune. That's all who was there, just the two of us. And so we're sitting down with Brad and I went, this is unreal. And you had access to people that you don't today, and the access was great, and so I got to know coaches and everything, and that year was very instructive. And then the San Diego, there was an opening on the beat, and I got to know a San Diego reporter just from covering the league, you know. And he said, oh, I think there's a guy in Baltimore who wants out, and that was me. And so I was interviewed there, took over, and that started. I love covering that team, and I love living in San Diego. Who wouldn't? And it was great for young single guy. And it was fun covering that team and Don Coryell and Fouts and those guys. It was a blast. I mean, really had fun. And then moving up to the Bay Area in 94, I realized that was going to be the ultimate challenge because they were covered by, I think at that time, 13 newspapers. You know, it's dwindled obviously now. Newspapers, TV, radio. I've never seen a media contingent like that. And someone said to me, you're not going to survive up here because it's a whole different ball game. And I thought, okay, we'll see. We'll just see. And I will say I proved them wrong. So I really enjoyed that there.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're talking at the end of the 80s and the early 90s and things like that, San Francisco, geez, I can't imagine how many people around the country were just major fans of that.
That's right.
Speaking of major fans, I have to kind of like backpedal you here a little bit. How were you a Colts fan when you were a New England born child?
Well, I wasn't a New England born child. I was born in Pennsylvania. And my dad was in the service. He was in three wars. He was in the World War II, Korean War, and then he led the 5th Marines in Vietnam. And my dad, when he went off to Korea, we lived in Pennsylvania, his hometown, one of my mom's hometown too. And once he came back, we then started moving from base to base. We went to Quantico, then went out to Hawaii and lived in Honolulu, and then we came back to Norfolk. And we moved all over the place. But my parents only moved to Connecticut in 73 after he left the service. And so I came back here. But no, I was a Colts fan because the first game I ever saw, I'll give you an idea of my age, but the first game I ever saw on TV was the 58 Colts Giants championship game. And I never forgot it. And I fell in love with Unitas. And in fact, if I could, I can't show you, but on my wall, got the great black and white photo by Robert Rieger. It's a 14 by 20 photo of John Unitas in that game. I've got this on my desk.
John Unitas, there you go.
and I've got a huge picture that I saw at the Colts facility and that my wife actually got for me through the photographer of Raymond Berry, another big 14 by 20 photo of Raymond Berry, two guys that I loved. And I wrote them when I was a kid, and I got responses from each one of them. And I got a long letter from Berry, and Unitas signed a football for me. I mean, it's to me and everything. And Then I have a photo of Unitas on my wall back here. That was it was taken in Westminster where they practice. He signed that. And I just loved what he represented and still do. I mean, people ask about the great quarterbacks. They talk about Montana and Brady. I said, yeah, in the modern era. But, I mean, I'm talking about the Super Bowl era. If you want to talk pre-Super Bowl, it's Unitas. And I said to my dad, you know, have you ever seen anyone like him? He goes, yeah, I have. Otto Graham. And then you start learning about Otto Graham. You go, my God, 10 years, 10 championship games. He won 7 of them. I mean, guys are incredible. But in this day and age, we don't remember what happened more than 5 minutes ago. And it's sad to me. Unitas was the greatest quarterback I ever saw in my lifetime. He was. And I recall, I always tell people this, a conversation that we had in New Orleans during the Super Bowl when there were 8 reporters sitting around a table at a restaurant, our favorite restaurant, Manali's, in New Orleans. And we're sitting around this table during the Super Bowl. It's like a Wednesday night. And Dan Henning showed up. And I knew Dan from when I was covering the Redskins. I was down there part-time from Baltimore. But he was the offense coordinator of the Redskins. Then he became the head coach of the Chargers. Knew Dan very well. And so Dan comes over the table, knows most of us, and he said, okay, listen, question for all you guys. You have 2 minutes left. You're down by 4 points. What quarterback do you choose to drive the length of the field? And he started with me. I said, Unitas. And then someone said, Montana. Someone said, Namath, Stabler, Unitas, Montana. Okay, Unitas. And it went around. And so I finished and said, okay, cool. Very good. Thanks, guys. And I said, wait, Dan, you can tell us who you would take. And he goes, there's only one choice here, guys. It's John Unitas. And he left. And that's the way I felt. But that's old school. And yet I will tell you, I carried around a video of the 58 championship game. I'd show it to anybody today. And I said, I defy you to find a better down the field passer or a better ball handler. I mean, he's doing play action fakes. You tell me who's got the ball. You can't tell. Unitas was a great quarterback, a tough quarterback. And I admired everything about him, including the fact that he won. You know, everything. He could win. He was a great winner. He's tough. But that's why I like a guy like Montana, who I covered, and Brady. I mean, I think Brady's extraordinary because he wins. I mean, I love guys. As Herm Edwards says, you play the game to win. He's right. I mean, I just sort of look at these people who are, you know, they're nitpicking with Brady's arm. Brady, you know, he wins. He wins 77% of his games. I mean, the only guy who's better? Otto Graham. So when we talk about, I saw somebody last year, I think it was Chris Sims, did a top 10 of quarterbacks. I don't think he had either Unitas or Graham in his top 10. And I'd immediately just dismiss that. I go, I don't understand these people. It's like that era didn't even exist. So great quarterbacks.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not saying that that's the reason why I started the show, but as I started the show to learn more about the history of the game, because so I was born in 85, so a Detroit Lions fan. I grew up like how you clung on to Johnny Unitas. For me, it was Barry Sanders. It's no secret on this show. Everybody knows that that's my guy. But I knew nothing about really even before that era. I mean, I knew the different, you know, we've heard of the Lombardis and we've heard of the greatest game ever. And we've heard of those other things, my generation. But until I started digging deep in that, like that Otto Graham one that you mentioned, that blew me away. I won't say more than any stat I've ever seen, but I'm like 10 straight championships. Granted, I know they were different leagues, but that's just crazy to think about it. And I know it was a different era, but just all these different things that people just, I'm hoping that through this show, we can continue to get more of that information out there. And we just, maybe not directly, but like interested, then go find stuff themselves and that kind of thing. And that kind of brings me to maybe the next question. You started a show, the Talk of Fame Network. What was the genesis of that and how did that all come about?
A lot of it came about from what you were talking about. My affection for history as well as others. And two of my closest friends in this business were Rick Oslin of Dallas Morning News and Ron Borges of the Globe and the Herald in Boston. And I said, listen, what do you think if we did something involving the Hall of Fame? Because we started this, I think, 7 years ago. And I said, if you think about it, nobody's doing anything with a Pro Football Hall of Fame. There's an opening there. I mean, they're covering everything about the game today, but they're not covering anything about the people who made that game today. And there are plenty of guys out there waiting to be talked to. Barry Sanders, for instance, plenty of guys out there who no one's talking to because they don't care about him anymore. They don't care because there is a real sort of, to me, a indifference towards history, and I'm not just talking about sports, I'm talking about all history, that really bothers me. And I was a history major in college, and really bothers me. And I thought, we've got a chance here to go into create a niche that nobody else has gone into. So they thought it was a good idea. We pitched it to a number of people. They liked the idea. And we said, we'll do a website along with a radio show. And we did that. And then we pitched it to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And for numbers of reasons, they weren't supportive, and we were the ones that actually sort of backed away from them because they wanted some things done that we just didn't agree with. And so we ended up going with someone else, another carrier, and it was great. And we had fun with it. And we ended up doing exactly what I wanted to get done, which was bring attention to some people, even if it's one, but some people who are deserving, who hadn't got it. And I said to my wife, if there's nothing else that happens while we're doing this, I want to see Ray Guy get in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I didn't cover the AFL, I covered the NFL, but I know what the AFL meant. I know who great players were in the AFL. Ray Guy was a great player, and he wasn't in the AFL. It was the Oakland Raiders, of course, when they were in the NFL. But Ray Guy was a great player, and to me, he was the punter you talked about. I know Gerald Wilson's a great punter, but Ray Guy, I just always thought about great punter. And why isn't he in the Pro Football Hall of Fame? I didn't understand, so I got into that group, and then when we were arguing, it was Ron Borges who made the argument, and he's the one who carried the day. And when we got out of there, I said, if I leave tomorrow, my mission's accomplished. Not that I got him in, but I did argue for him. And it was a passionate argument on both sides. And I was so glad that happened. But we've done more of that with others. Morton Anderson's another one. Same thing, specialist. Ron, again, he didn't make the case, but he dropped the hammer on people who were trying to keep him out. Jerry Kramer. I mean, Jerry Kramer, how could Jerry Kramer not be in? And we get pushing hard long enough. And that's what I care passionately about. Those guys that I watch, it would be as if I said to you, listen, nobody cares about Barry Sanders. Obviously they do. But if I said to you, you know, they've forgotten him. And you go, they can't. We're going to try to keep his name and his memory alive. And that's, I think of some of those guys that I watched growing up. Mike Curtis is a good one. He just passed away. Mike Curtis is a great linebacker, but I would bet if you asked most of your listeners who he is, they wouldn't know. And that's too bad because Mike Curtis is a Hall of Fame worthy linebacker. But most of the guys in that room, I don't think, and I'm speaking out of line here because I haven't quizzed them. Let me say a lot of the guys in that room, I'm talking about the Pro Football Hall of Fame voters, may not have heard of him and may not have seen him, probably haven't seen him. And that's too bad. Or they've seen the film clip of him nailing that fan coming out of the stands during the Dolphins game at Memorial Stadium. But that's it. So I look at guys like that. Jerry Kramer, there's another guy, Johnny Robinson. We carry the case for Johnny Robinson, but we got these guys on the radio. We got them on, and then we start pushing. And the thing that resonated with me was when some people within that room, and I'm talking about the Hall of Fame Board of Selectors, when we meet once a year, they'd say, well, Rick and Ron and Clark on their show had this guy, and they said this, and he said this, and I went, we've made an impact. We've actually made an impact. That's all I cared about. And I don't know whether it's run its course or not now, but I really wanted to do something like that. I see some other people now are sort of doing that. But our point is we've seen as much football as any observers who are writing daily today. Because we go back, as I mentioned to you, the first game I saw was 58. So I'd always say to people, well, I've seen everyone from Johnny Unitas to Johnny Manziel, you know? And so that doesn't mean that we're more in tune to them than anyone else, but we are at least attuned to them because we know what's going on with them. And then when some of these senior candidates come out, like a guy like Duke Slater, we were leading the charge where some people are going, who? Who? And others, I mean, Max Speedy is a guy I've fought for a long time. He got in with a Centeno class. I consider that a minor victory. Not that I carried him across the finish line, but that we actually brought his name to the fore. So it's because of things like that. Guys that I care passionately about and an era of football that I cared passionately about.
And you keep talking about the Hall of Fame Selectors Committee. Were you in there first or were you in Talk of Fame first?
I was in there first, yeah. And I got in there as a replacement in 95. And I remember speaking up on behalf of Mike Haynes when some of the older guys who no longer on there, like, no, you're not going. No, you're not going. And so I was just a replacement, and I was sort of like, I'm going to defer to everyone else. And then I was a replacement in 2012 for Len Shapiro, and spoke up on Curtis Martin's behalf. I remember that well. And then from 2012, I mean, from then, from that time on, I've been in. And so in 2013, we created the Talk of Fame Network, but we didn't go on the air full time till 2014. So, they dovetailed.
You said you were kind of like a replacement for like interim. How does the process even work to become a selector?
You're chosen by the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I suspect, without asking anyone there, but I suspect it's done. It used to be Joe Horgan, who was the executive VP of communications there. He sort of ran the whole thing, and he knew whom to get, because he'd say, I want somebody who knows a lot about the game itself, who's covered a team, and who's got a sense of history. And he came to me years before, and he said, I'd like to put you on, but I can't because you're married to someone in the NFL. And I said, what does that have to do with it? And he goes, it makes you biased. I said, I don't get that, but that's okay. So someone said, well, what about so-and-so? He works for the NFL Network. You don't have a problem with that. But that was a pretty good question, you know? And so when they have someone who's can't make it for that date, he's sick, he's got an emergency, something happens so that he can't make it to the Super Bowl, we've got to find a replacement. So they'll go, we'll get Clark Judge, you know? I mean, okay, so he's got his wife's, the NFL. He's just doing it. He's an interim, all right? So they brought me in there. But then he asked me in 2013. And at that point, my wife was no longer working at the NFL. And so I thought that opened the door for me. But we've got people from the NFL Network who are working on there now. So I don't know how that changed. But Joe's gone, unfortunately. But I think the process is still the same, that they basically kind of look at, they have an idea as to who's out there, got a sense of history. Who's covered a team for whatever reason. I think that's a prereq. I don't know that I would make that a prereq. There's some really good football historians out there. Good. I mean, really sharp guys. John Turney, Pro Football Journal. Todd Tobias, Tales from the AFL. Ken Crippen. Dan Daly does a great job. They're great historians. TJ Turney, terrific historian. Chris Willis, he works at NFL Films. They know, they study the film. And they've watched these guys. So when you ask them about a player from the 40s or 50s, and that people go, I don't know anything about him. They've watched film, and they've broken it down, and they've studied these guys. I don't understand why they're not on there. And I made a proposal about, I think, a half a year ago, saying things that I'd like to see change. That's one of the things I want to see change. Put some historians on there. I care whether they covered a team or not. Because when I covered a team, I will tell you this, when you're covering a team, that's all you care about, because that's what you're great at. At least it used to be. Now I'm not sure, because most of the news comes out of the internet and it's not guys who are there daily. But when I was covering a team, you lived and breathed that thing, and you didn't want to get beaten, because everything was based on, so it was a report card, how you did that day. You got the break on the big story, got an A, you go to the front of the class. You missed it. Okay. Don't miss too many. We'll find someone else to replace you. And so you did that team. And then all of a sudden your team, for instance, like the 49ers, let's say they don't make it to the Super Bowl. Now suddenly they go, you're going to the Super Bowl, but as a Hall of Fame rep. Oh, and I'm going to be asked to look at what? Curtis Martin, these guys. And so you do a quick study, like for a day or two. What we're doing is living it now. I mean, Ron, Rick and I are living it. We're doing that every day. That's what I like about it. And that's what I'm dealing with these historians who are just terrific, and they know what they're talking about. Unlike, unfortunately, many people today.
Yeah, I would think that, like you said, I mean, if they're living it, breathing that every single day, a particular team, I mean, not even, let's just even get past the biasness. You're talking, you don't have enough time to really consume all that history content as far as when they're bringing in. And I guess that was one thing also I wanted to ask about was.
And I just want to say, I don't begrudge them that's their responsibility, is their team. I don't begrudge them. If they don't know what's going on with Max Speedy in the 50s, I don't begrudge them that, because that's not what they're paid to do. They're paid to cover the Kansas City Chiefs or the Baltimore Ravens. So I don't begrudge them that.
No, yeah. I mean, in my day job, I'm quality assurance manager. So if I don't know exactly what's going on in production, then, you know, it doesn't mean that I don't have a little bit of an insight. But at the same time, there's no way anybody could expect me to know what's going on in the day-to-day operation. So totally makes sense. And inside the room, because you are living it and breathing it, does that kind of, I don't know, do you and Rick and Ron kind of bring forward some of these older players a little bit more?
Oh, sure. No, that's absolutely right. Rick, especially, he's got a real thorough knowledge of a lot of the older players, and he brings them to our attention. And then we start doing studies on them. He started the State Your Case idea, which we do on talkoffamenetwork.com every Tuesday. And it's from players from the past. And it could be 80 years ago, you know, 90 years ago, could be 20 years ago. So we'll bring those names to the fore, suggesting that they should be in a Hall of Fame conversation. And I just recently did a month-long study of the AFL and basically got 15 people as my jurors and said, I want to pick the 10 best players from the AFL who are not in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Who are they? And I had five of those historians that I mentioned, five Hall of Fame voters. Rick and Ron are two of them, but they were all members of the senior committee, John McLean, Ira Kaufman, Ira Miller, and then five others, including Art Shell, who's a Hall of Famer. And got them to whittle this list of 52 preliminary candidates down to 10. And it was interesting to me and instructive, but that's to bring those names back to the fore in the hope that somebody at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, some of those voters will go, hey, wait a second. Why aren't we considering someone like Tom Sestak? Well, I mean, for the senior committee. How about some of these guys like Lionel Taylor? What? Why is Charlie Hannigan not in here? These guys are all worthy. And yet, as I said, and I'm not knocking the other guy. I'm just saying, if you go around that room, just because it gets younger as you know, we get older, it gets younger. They go, Charlie Hannigan, how many of you, raise your hands, ever heard of him? Be curious how many people raise their hands.
Yeah, I'm one of them that I couldn't raise my hand, except for I did see that article come out recently. And with that being said, the senior committee, could you kind of at least describe how that works a little bit?
Yeah, it's nine guys, subcommittee. There are 48 Hall of Fame selectors, and 46 of them are writers, broadcasters, whatever. And then we have Dan Fouts and James Lofton, both of whom are in the entertainment industry, sports entertainment industry as broadcasters, but former players and Hall of Famers. So it's 48 selectors. Of that group of 48, we have nine members who comprise a senior subcommittee. And each year they put forth a candidate or candidates for consideration. It always was two in the past until 2014, when they said, okay, we're going to now put forth a contributor category. And that's a contributor subcommittee. And I'm a member of that, also nine members. And each year we're going to have one subcommittee propose one guy and the other two, and alternating years. So the first year it was two contributors, one senior. Next year, two seniors, one contributor. One contributor, so just keep two contributors, one senior, keep going back and forth for 5 years. We're at the end of 5 years now. And I think the lesson we've learned from that, which is something I pointed out at the beginning, was there are far more seniors here to consider than there are contributors. Why are we cutting the seniors from 2 to 1 every other year? It's ridiculous. And it makes no sense. And I think you saw that with the Centennial Committee, the list of qualified candidates there. And for instance, the 10 finalists who weren't included, you know, Drew Pearson. Why is Drew Pearson not in the Pro Football Hall of Fame? He didn't make it. His first team all decade, 1970s. He didn't make it. I mean, it's just, what? He didn't make the final cut. So I think what was done there was an experiment that's over. Now, what happens going forward? I think they're going back to two seniors every year because they realize there's such a volume of seniors who are qualified for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, we can't propose any fewer than two each year. What happens to the contributors? My guess is that contributors and coaches either are lumped together or that they're going to go every other year. So it'd be two seniors, one contributor. Next year, two seniors, one coach. Now, there's not a separate coaches category. We know that, except what just happened with the Centennial Committee. They put two coaches in, you know, from a coaches list. They had a separate category. They had a contributor category and the coaches. So you had three contributors and two coaches. Bill Cowher and Jimmy Johnson were the coaches. Well, that leads to the question, are we now doing a coaches category? No answer to that. And I don't think it's going to be resolved until this coming year. So in any case, I do think we're going back to two seniors, which is necessary. Then whether it's one contributor, which means a contributor and a coach, or if it's one contributor 1 year and one coach from a coaches category next year, I think it's going to be 2-1, 2-1, 2-1, but the two being the seniors.
And you mentioned how it's necessary to go back to two seniors, going back to your state, your cases. If you could put your flag on just one senior from the past that hasn't been in, I'd probably challenge you, but what senior would you pick? Oh boy. I'm going to have to leave you hanging to find out what senior Clark would pick if he could only pick one. Speaking of that, if I asked you what player, coach, or contributor should be in the Hall of Fame, who would you pick? If you're interested, well, go ahead, feel free. You can send it in with the recording, and we'll play it on the show. You can do this and more when you head over to my page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. But for now, dudes, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.